But back to the Trump troll, President troll. He is. I mean, he's not the president of America. He's the king of white trash. I mean, he, Bubba, you know, wrestling, NASCAR, Cousin Love. And I hate to say this about, you know, certain element of the white. Because white people, you know, they're trying to convince us that they're diverse. Because we like white people. You know, or as a censored version of what Khalid said, a white person is a white person is a white person is a white person. But I was just watching this show yesterday when there was a German white woman and a Irish white man talking about their ethnic divergence and ethnic differences and how they're rich, diverse, you know, river dance and, you know, fecal porn. I don't know. For German people, I don't know. They're rich, diverse cultural heritages is. But I guess we are not, you know, because, you know, an Irish cop, a German cop, just a white cop to us. But maybe if we acknowledge their rich cultural heritage. But there's a certain class divisions, you know, where most people in the United States who aren't middle class like to believe they're middle class. But then you have the lower class. And, you know, this is why, because I used to work in a Missouri hospital. And this was the first time in my life where I saw different classes of white people interact on a regular basis. So you had, and I'm going somewhere with this. You had affluent whites, the doctors, the administrators, some lawyers, you know, and even nurses. You know, and a lot of these were liberals. Some of the physicians were white people with dreads or matted fur, whatever you want to call it. And they would interact with white folks who lived in trailers, who had literally, and if you don't believe me, we can go to the Ozarks. I can take you to central southern Missouri that literally had dirt floors and outhouses. Like one time there was a guy who came into the emergency room. He was a victim of let me finish the affluent side. Like I would talk to some of these doctors and a lot of them were liberal, left leaning, because that's why they were working there as opposed to working at one of the more upscale facilities, healthcare facilities. But these people who made six figures, upper six figures, you know, who owned boats. I mean, I think that's it. You know, black folks think getting a nice Bugatti or something, a boat, a yacht, I think is really, you know, the white version of a fancy car. Black folks, you get a nice car, you've made it. White folks, they gotta work harder to get up to a boat. But anyway, but they would talk to me about their upbringing, very cultured, very well traveled, who spoke multiple languages, who have not only had passports, but the passports was full of stamps, you know, and so these are, and that would talk to me about, you know, various philosophies and political ideologies. And, you know, I'm like, oh, these are some well-polished, well-hewn white folks. And they, and like I said, in one of the cases, and this is no lie, there was a redneck. And they called themselves that, so why can't I say it? You call yourselves that word, the R word? Okay, let's call it the R word. The R words would come into the... And there was one R word who literally had like second-degree burns from an exploded tractor tire. And I don't know if you've ever been around a tractor tire, but you got to do a lot to make a tractor tire explode. This is like military-grade, you know, material. Tractor tires are huge. They can be 12 feet tall sometimes. Some of those turbines are 6 feet tall. But I didn't see the accident. I didn't get the details. But somehow, this R word made a tractor tire explode. And, of course, they always came in with a strong stench of, like, not like alcohol. You know, I had drinky-drinky uncles. Wasn't really my uncle. It was my grandmother's I don't know if I should be saying it was my grandmother's boyfriend, but since she was a good Christian woman, they couldn't be like, this my bae. So she's like, hey, it's Uncle Martin, who's grandma's good friend, whatever. But, you know, he liked to get his sippy sip on. And it's a different kind of smell of alcohol. Now, I don't know if it's better or worse. I'm not a drinker, but they had always had this smell of alcohol, but it was unlike a smell I ever knew. They were always belligerent. And they didn't really like being brought, even though this was Kansas City, Missouri, to them being brought to Truman Medical Center was like being brought to the big city, like being brought to a foreign land. So they were always a little nervous and belligerent. Like, what am I doing here? Because a lot of times when the rural hospitals, the rural clinics didn't have the facilities to help them. So they'd send them to Truman Medical Center. And I'd see the white people would have so much, the affluent whites would have so much disdain for these R words. And now these are people who, you know, were dealing with gang members, shooting and stabbings, black drug addicts who would have overdoses, you know, black abuse victims, black abusers. And, you know, I just, you know, off of GP, I'd say, hey, affluent white person, must be racist. But when you would bring in an R word, when the R words would come in, I'm telling you, they just had such utter disgust for these people. And I would overhear them talking, you know, because I was like Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. My philosophy when I was a tech was I was one with the machine, very Zen Buddhist type. I am one with the equipment. So that allowed me not to be in there cussing people out, you know, allow me to get in, get my paycheck and get out of there. Like, it didn't work as well. I'm no longer in that industry. So maybe I wasn't as good as merging with the machine and becoming one with the machine as I thought, which is actually my real topic, jobs. I want to talk about jobs. But anyway, they had such class hatred. And a lot of times I would see their class hatred be much more intense than their racial animosities. And I'd never seen that before because me, I was poor and black and in the Midwest. So I had all black community, all black school, all black church, all black public transit, all black stores, all black everything. And it wasn't a matter of pride. It was a matter of poverty. You know, couldn't afford to be around anybody but other poor black folks. Which, hey, I'm not complaining. Thank you. I'm happy. You know, I'm glad my parents were not strivers. Because of what I've seen, some of these other brothers and sisters that I've met over the course of my life that did have the wonders and wonderful opportunities for a multi-ethnic upbringing. I'll take my all-black everything, even impoverished, over all the rest of that. You know, I don't think I had a non-black teacher. Well, once I had two white teachers when I was put in special ed in the fifth grade. But after that, all my teachers were black up until high school. And I would have had a black high school experience let's not get into that. Shout out to Bishop Hogan. Some dude that I know, someone of my back in the day, Block Brothers, tried to, you know, out me for going to a Catholic high school as if I made that decision. You know, whatever. Yeah, I went to a Catholic high school, study under nuns to become a Catholic fool. And there's something I got to say about that. Let me get off of the interclass conflicts and interclass animosities of white people, put that on the shelf, and talk about when I went to a Catholic school. One thing, and again, this was a somewhat diverse. They were not just black folks, but. And one day, maybe I'll tell the story how I landed in a Catholic school when I didn't have enough money to pay attention. And they got me in a school where I have to pay tuition, you know. But anyway, I never saw such debauchery. I thought hood school, you know, coming out of Southeast, East Hills Village, you know, Kansas City folks, they all know what I'm talking about. They know the reputations of these neighborhoods and these schools. Coming out of East Hill Village, not the East Hill Village now, I mean the East Hill Village of the 80s and 90s. And then going to Southeast junior high. I'm not going to name names because some people are still out there, still got warrants or whatever. But, and so going to Bishop Hogan, I thought, wow, this will be an oasis. It'll be an opportunity to get away from the madness of the neighborhood several hours a day, 5 days a week. And maybe on the weekends, I'll join the audition to be in the spring play. I'll join the cross country team. I'll do debate and DI. So I'll get away from the hood even more. You know, some peace. But when I got there, there wasn't the violence. There wasn't the angry, but there was a lot of debauchery. Again, I'm not going to out nobody. You know, when I was in the hood, I would only see like a little weed, a little 40 ounce. This is the 40 ounce days. Y'all, now the rappers didn't introduce y'all to Alizé and Armadale. But back then, all it was 40 and a blunt. Maybe some Mad Dog 2020 on the weekend. But it was beer, malt liquor, and blunt weed. I didn't know about horse tranquilizers and pill popping and roofies and all that stuff. These good Catholic folks. And I entered Hogan at the time where the white people were cycling out and the colored folks who had means were cycling in. It was still in transition when I entered my freshman year. And I went to a couple of parties where they were playing more than just DJ Quick and Too Short. They were playing, you know, rock and roll, you know, like Guns N' Roses, multiracial parties. And it was so much debauchery. The only difference is nobody was watching the white kids. Like, if they policed white communities like they policed black communities, it'd be white mass incarceration. There'd be middle class, affluent white women in prison demanding, I want to speak to the warden. This is unacceptable. You know, my cellie, you know, they'd be in there white peopling in jail instead of white peopling at Marshall's and Walmart. But nobody watches them. So, you know, we like to think black folks, we always crimey. We always up to no good. And our rappers, our middle class rappers like Ice Cube, O'Shea Jackson, who ain't never popped a cherry. Ain't never went, and you know, O'Shea Jackson, middle class. You know, Jay-Z told us he ain't even started spending his rap money yet. He's still spending his dope money from running Marcy Projects. We all know that's a lie. But that's what we thought. We thought we was badass. But then, like I said, I went to Catholic school and I saw such debauchery. But, and the black students, y'all did y'all thing. And I'm thinking, these nuns, Sister Mary Platt, Steve Douche, and I can say their names because those are the school staff. These nuns, these modern reformed Catholics, progressives, they didn't really get up in arms about it. You had to take 4 years of theology class. And they would teach us the Catholic religion. They would teach us about morality and piety and reverence to God. And the girls would be sitting there with their school skirts hiked up, you know, all the way up. I mean, they would cut those skirts all the way up, you know, like the sexy schoolgirl thing. And the dudes be sitting there and they, you know, for some reason they found a little niche in the uniform code where it turned out we didn't have uniforms. We had a dress code. And it just turns out the Dickies fit the dress codes. Dickies were pretty much classified as slacks. So you had these Catholic school kids. They weren't really rollers, but they would wear Dickies and Cortez, and they'd be in there looking like cholos, you know. And I guess the Catholic school, these old nuns and stuff, they didn't know what they were looking at. But, you know, everybody was trying to be a gangster. I, with my dumb behind, would be in there with a tie on while you know, this, you know, going to and from public housing, you know, ducking bullets and drive-bys. And these kids coming from, you know, two-parent households with a front and backyard, you know, not on Section 8 or welfare and food stamps and housing vouchers. They would come there looking like I said, cholos, dickied out, dickies. And I'm thinking, huh, you know, these kids aren't paying attention to this stuff. These stupid Catholics, these idiotic Catholics, mostly white, are here talking all this morality, talking all this Christian propaganda, but the students are debauch. Me too. I was in it, you know. I was listening to Ice-T and doing the WAP and the Cabbage Patch and grinding on any girl merciful enough to let me get my little grind on in the little house party. You know, the party shack. Remember the party shack, y'all? And remember, what's that, Blankenship, that basement, that fire trap? You know, I was there. I'm not exempting myself from this. And I thought, why these nuns, these priests, they used to make us go to mass and we'd have these Catholic retreats. I mean, along with the academic stuff. Yeah, we had algebra and English and history. And I campaigned my senior year. We finally got in black or African studies and black history. Yeah, you know, I integrated the curriculum of business. I told you, I already admit I started off as a liberal integrationist before I came a Pan-African revolutionary. So, yeah. You know, I helped Bishop Hogan bring its first African-American or black history study class, because before it was just history, which was all white nonsense from a Catholic perspective. And but then they hired like a 22-year-old, fresh out of undergrad, white girl to teach me at 18 history. And then I would go into history class berating her because of her lack of grasp of the topic. And then the black students would attack me for attacking the white teacher who's failing to teach us our proper history. Yeah. Okay. But that's not my point. And so, anyway, I'm thinking these Catholics are stupid. But they didn't really get too caught up. Students doing all this debauchery. I mean, debauchery. The kind of debauchery, wealthy debauchery, rich debauchery, middle class, upper class, oligarchical debauchery. Y'all poor people think y'all really get up to some dirt. Y'all really think y'all so hood, so street. We wilding out, you know, drinking, smoke, I drank, you know, sex, debauch, sex. No, loose morals. No, you ain't seen debauchery until you get to pussy grabbing billionaire debauchery. That's some real slackness. That's some real slackness. And that's, you know, slackness is a West Indian term for either foolishness, nastiness, or debauchery, really. For my non-multilingual listeners. But then, this is something I noticed growing into adulthood. Eventually, all of that religious Western Christian propaganda seeped out. And some of the wildest cats from Bishop Hogan, and when I say wild, not hood wild, but middle class kid, you know, humping around, you're backpacking through Europe, having, you know, loose sex in hostile type wild, you know, at a spring break in Mexico, drinking and passing out type, frat boy wild, not shoot up the block type, moving bricks type wild. Again, I'm talking about Catholic school people, youth. Some of the wildest cats are now, they're all religious. It's like they, like the Catholics knew they were planting these seeds. See, but now I understand it. Back then, at 15, 16, I didn't understand what they were doing. I just thought, hey, these people, but they were planting seeds. And a lot of the cats that I know from Hogan, and y'all know who, that were wildest cats. And sisters, wild is what you call sphinx, I don't know, the sisters too, the ladies, are now all some of the most Bible-thumping, Jesus-humping-ass Christians you'd ever want to see. They have all been delivered. And I'm like, wow, okay. So you just plant your seeds and keep it moving. And they don't even know. They swear that they came to the Lord under their own direction. And they may not be Catholic. Some of them are. But they bow to one Western God or another. They are Christians. And whatever you say, the Catholic Church, the Vatican, is still the head of the Christian Church, Western Christianity. And you can be Protestant, you can be Anglican, but you're just a bastard child of the Pope. You know. So all you little Christian, that's the Holy Roman Empire. Constantine, you still bowing to the cross? You still claiming Jesus Christ is your Lord and Savior? You can talk all you want about the Pope ain't real, the Pope this, but yeah, hey, you a bastard. Protestantism is the bastard child of Catholicism and Western imperialism. But anyway, and I'm like, whoa, that's cold-blooded. So shout out to Sister Mary Pat, Steve Duchin, Mr. Parsons, all of you Catholic propagandists. Because y'all really, y'all taught me a lesson. And that's why a lot of times, you know, I'll give some information, I'll drop some seeds, and I don't even stick around to cultivate the seeds a lot of times. I say, respect yourself, love yourself, black power, black liberation, down with capitalism. People are like, what are you talking about? Black people treated me worse than anybody. But, you know, here's the thing about propaganda, though, because that's not, you know, even dropping, because propaganda, the root of the word propaganda means to propagate, to have it ongoing. So, you know, it wasn't just Bishop Hogan. It was Bishop Hogan was one segment of a larger system of mass indoctrination. So what you learn in school is reinforced by what you see on TV. What you see on TV is reinforced by what you hear on radio. What you hear on the radio is reinforced by what you hear from your peers. What you hear from your peers is reinforced by the billboards and advertisement. You know, and what you see on the billboards is reinforced by, you know, your job. You know. And what you get at your job is reinforced by how you entertain yourself. Watching Super Bowl, and you look at the football game, and you see jets flying over, and the Star Spangled Banner, and half naked women gyrating, football, football, football. And you're like, huh, I like me some football. Why do you like football? Because it's my own individual choice. And, you know, it's just a coincidence that I've made the choice, the exact same choice, as 200 million other people. And then I vote, and what team do you like? I like the team from my town. Why? Because it's my town. Why? And people really think these are my thoughts. And I came up with this. And you could have put me in Borneo. You could have put me in Swaziland. You could put me in Tasmania. And I would have come to these same conclusions. I wouldn't be doing, you know, I mean, you are a product. And there's nothing wrong with that if it's your culture and your society that was built by your ancestors for your betterment and interest and development. But if it's an alien culture that you've been indoctrinated to, you've got problems. Problems that span generations. Problems that generate your DNA, your very chromosomes, and be passed on for generations. So you got to purge. Anyway, this is a brief lesson. So let's get all the way back to the Trump troll show. Trump is not a statesman. And what you have to do, because it used to be when Obama, remember the Obama days way back when? Obama was doing, and this is what I'm trying to, Obama did the same stuff that Trump is doing. He just did it with statesmanship, whereas Trump does it with a carnival flair. You see, when he announced that right-wing lunatic justice, he comes out and it's like Ricky Lake, come from behind the curtain, you know, and then the judge comes out, it's all this pizzazz. Obama was assigning mad executive orders, but he didn't have a press conference for every executive order. He didn't line up his goons from tallest to shortest. You know, he didn't tweet. Remember the whole controversy in 2008 when they were trying to take away Obama's BlackBerry? And Obama was the BlackBerry president. Obama was the first president to truly master and truly understand the new media. And he used the new media with a surgical precision to secure the White House. But after he became president, they said, give me that BlackBerry, boy. But I likes it. Give it to me, boy. And they took his BlackBerry away. Trump don't, because, and why did Obama give up his BlackBerry? Because he was a statesman. And he says, you know, I got to rep the U.S. government. And so what if it was founded by rapists, pedophiles, enslavers, and thieves, and murderers? You know. That turd has been polished to precision, and now the United States is a legitimate and respected nation. And I have to carry. Trump has just thrown all that to the wind. Right? Trump is the president, and that takes me all the way back to you have these class divisions within white folks. Now, it used to be these class divisions were well articulated. They would teach you about class stratification. They would teach dialectics. They would teach us the history of class struggle. But they don't teach that anymore. People don't even know what class they're in. You got poor people saying they middle class. You got lower middle class people thinking they balling out of control, that they rich. I'm rich. You see those two cars? I got it. I'm rich. People don't understand. You got people who own no stock, who don't live off their dividends, who go to work every day and collect a wage, who really believe they're capitalist. You know, so you got a lot of people, they don't know where they stand. Everybody's confused. They don't know who they should align with. You got black people who don't accept they black. You got white people who swear they are black. Dolezal, So, you know, nobody knows where they stand anymore. So it's really hard to even, you know, organize along class lines. But the elite whites, even though it's not structured, they've always had an ongoing. And a lot of times that hostility is rooted because they're just less than a generation removed from the dirt floor trailer house, outhouse. So maybe because it reminds them of where they come from, maybe because they think that, you know, they like are like the upper Negroes. These white folks is bringing us down, but they're sophisticated enough not to write it on social media or publish books or go around like Bill Cosby talking about how the poor whites are bringing us down. You'll never hear Bill Gates saying, you know, I'm trying to improve my improve the world, but these poor whites want to act like our words and bring the whole race down. Now, white elites and white upper class don't do that, but they have those same sentiments, but they just don't articulate them the way uppity Negroes do. So anyway, those are internal class divisions. And working at Truman's Medical Center for the first time, I really saw white class play out in real time. It wasn't just something I would have to go and read, you know, Trotsky or go read Marx and Engels to really understand class division, or read Howard Zinn to understand these ongoing class hostilities among white people. And then the white people would say, like, get in a huddle. The white physicians, the white doctors and respiratory therapists, like, look at that guy. He looks inbred. They're inbred. You know, that's a common thing. They would, like, always accuse them of being inbred, having extra chromosomes and stuff because, you know. So but you know, a lot of black people really have this thing that we think whites are unified. Like, how do they succeed? But if success in America or success in the world or wealth was based on unity, then whites would really be the most impoverished people because they're not a unified people. They got certain things that they can rally around, certain common goals and interests, but they're not unified, even in execution. So Trump has become the king, even though Trump has a deep-seated desire to belong to be accepted and recognized by these upper crust. Who had never, like, oh, there was a song. It was called Freestyling at the Fortune 500 by The Coup. Boots and E-Rock, Pam the Functress, you know. So the early stage, I think it was on the, was it on Genocide and Juice or Steal This Album? So their second or third album, I think, they had a song called Freestyling at the Fortune 500 Club. And they have a segment where they had Getty, one of the oligarchs, and DuPont rapping, and he said, you know, they're basically rapping about being elite. So the whole setup, it's a skit that Pryor's where Boots is in there. Basically, Boots is serving drinks to these elite rich white people, and they're talking like, you know, stuck up, you know, stereotypical, yes, yes, Buffy, ha, ha, ha. And he's like, oh, I heard you getting into this rapping thing. And he's like, yeah, I'm doing a little rapping. He's like, well, why don't you freestyle? And so E-Rock starts it off. He starts off as Getty and rapping about how they make money and oil deals and raping countries. And then the second verse is, I forget who the other guy is. It's a while since I listened to the song. I'm really anxious to go play it myself. But at the very end of the two billionaires saying their verses, Trump comes in, and the other oligarchs at the party are like, oh my God, here comes Trump. And they're like, oh, don't look at him. Oh my God, he's just so low class. We don't like him. Because class ain't just about money. Class is about your sensibilities, your mannerisms, your taste, you know, how you carry yourself, how you present yourself. That's a big part of class. So you got a lot of broke people that are upper class, like my wife. We're poor, but she's so, like, Cosby kid, you know, uppity. So, and it's not just money. Like, my wife could move among statesmen and diplomats and world travelers and speak French and, you know, talk about art, impressionism and all that. So she's actually, she can navigate upper classes, even though she don't have upper class money. Speaking of which, y'all got to get on my page and start donating. You know, I mean, come on now. Support the show now. Y'all want the show? That's the thing, man. I'm going to have to bring a can, literally, and shake it. Support the Bro Diallo show. Make some donations or some other things. You know, do something, man. Get behind the show. Anyway. So Trump comes over and is like, oh, I hear you guys are rapping. This is somebody, and this is 2 decades before Trump even thought about running for it. This is a long time ago. This is early 90s, y'all. And Trump was like, oh, I hear you doing that rapping reggae thing. And they were like, oh, no, we're just leaving. Go away, Trump. Go away. Because the oligarchs. And then Trump actually does like a reggae, like Trump, Trump, check out the Kashanami Trump. Trump, Trump, come check out some Kashanami Trump. Man, I'm on Donald Trump. You were about me. I'm my next wife. Come and try to take my money. It's an ill song. But it's very real. I don't know. Boots is like an atheist, communist prophet. Because remember he had that album Party Music that had the Twin Towers exploding before the government orchestrated 9/11 attacks? And he was pushing like a guitar tuner detonator and had both of the Twin Towers blowing up. And he had to change the album cover to somebody like serving a martini Molotov cocktail because the feds came down on him about that album cover. And if you got that album cover, you better hold on to it. The original album cover for Party Music. Okay, that original album cover. It might even be on that album. The songs are all kind of meshed together. So then he predicted, like, he didn't predict Trump's rise to power, but he acknowledged that Trump had a deep desire to be amongst the elites. But his natural place is amongst the R words, the white trash. Now, I didn't make up white trash. I personally would like to identify with my white class equivalents, the white poor, the white mass. I would like to. But I just know, just like with the brother Bird down in Texas, you get to drinking and chilling with white folks. Next thing you know, you tied to the back of a pickup being drugged to pulp. You know? So I would like to, but my knowledge of my history says that you have, you know, just like a registered sex offenders, a lot of y'all to me are registered race offenders. I can't trust you around people of color without you'd have to have monitored visitations. If I'm going to sit across from a working class or poor white person, there has to be a mediator, a moderator, or maybe some glass to partition. I didn't bring this to be. But you have had a ongoing predatory relationship with working class and poor people of color, black people particularly. But that's another discussion. Trump is, for years, for decades, has tried to buy his way, plead his way, dance his way, sing his way into the upper echelons of New York high society. And he's always been a laughingstock. They would always snicker behind his back. And there is no shade like oligarchical shade. You know, they mastered, you know, the whole very art of shading people, of degrading people without words, just with a look, with a glare. You know, look at the Queen Elizabeth and her mannerism, her facial expressions. How dare you? You know, they put their fingertips to their chest and tuck their chins in to their shoulder a little bit like, oh, and that's a denunciation. We get you thrown out of the ball without a word. You know, just gesturing. So Trump has always been the white trash king. And now he is officially the king of white trash America. Trailer park America. Wrestling. Not wrestling, but wrestling. You know, tractor pulls and monster trucks. You know. And that's, he's always, for most of his life, hated being associated with that. Trump is literally the poor man's billionaire. You know, a struggle billionaire, if he's still worth a billion, which is highly questioned. So Trump finally, under the Obama administration, accepted, I will never, ever, ever be a part of this. I will never be accepted by these oligarchs. So I'm just going to be me. I just got to be me. He decided, yo, not only am I going to embrace the fact that I can be the king of the R-words, the king of the trailer park, hand me my throne made of beer cans and the golden remote, you know, to the TV, because I am the king, you know. Give me my crown made of Hooter tank tops. You know, I don't know. I don't really know what It's been a minute since I've been to rural Missouri or rural Memphis. So I don't know. Whatever the real Americans are into. And he embraced that. And then he found out, wait, number one, they're the majority. These poorly educated, hateful, disenfranchised, they represent the majority. The oligarchs are the minority. They're well-armed, poorly educated, and easily riled up and easily led. So Trump finally embraced his destiny, the Rat King. And unlike Obama, because Obama took office with more power than Trump. Obama could have snapped his fingers and had a million black folks anywhere he wanted them to be doing whatever he told them to do. Black folks were in awe of a black man who made it to the white chair. They were in awe. And they would have done anything. And I know some cats. I know some felons who couldn't vote, but they were out there putting up yard signs, registering other people, you know, advocating, fighting for Obama. You know, I knew people who wouldn't, I mean, some money grubbing ass black folks who gave their money to Obama. Somebody, they let me tell you something, black people in 2008, Ronnie, or the guy that Obama's so fond of, Cousin Poopy, you got relatives in your family who owe you money that donated to the Obama campaign. They gave that $25, that sack of potato money. That gas money, you know, that school uniform money you lent them when I got to get Sharice her school uniform. School's in 2 weeks. I ain't got the money now. And you helped her and you gave her that money for them school uniforms. Right? That hair, that bundle money you lent to your cousin for her prom. A lot of that money went to Obama. People who owe their relatives money gave that money to Obama. Because that's how what a phenomenon that was. And Obama could have went on TV the next day and say, let me tell y'all something. This is a list of congressmen who are obstructing my agendas. This is their the number to their office. This is their email. And this is the address of their congressional office. Let the voice of the people be heard. I have spoken. And people would have went to that because people were finally. But what did Obama do when he took office? He said, okay, he demobilized his people. He gave up his BlackBerry. He took off those sunglasses. He took off those basketball high top sneakers. He started wearing. Remember, he used to wear the shirt with no tie, like Ahmadinejad. Like, hey, I'll wear a suit and a shirt, no tie. He didn't wear the American, and he put on a tie. You know. Remember, he used to have his hair cut. You know, he started letting the official white old White House barber cut his hair. He didn't even have a black haircut anymore. His fade and his lineup wasn't like it used to be when he was running for office. The Obama we voted for is not the Obamas that took office. But Obama was king of black folks. He was king of the liberals. He was king of the progressives. Obama had more power, more clout, more influence than Trump did taking office. Yet, where's the whirlwind? And not only that, racists were scared to death. Everybody was scared of Obama. All of Obama's political enemies were scared to death. Like, oh, this is the end. Go back to 2008. I know it's a long time ago, and the Americans, we live for today and we look to the future. Y'all don't like to study history, but this ain't even history. I mean, 10 years ago is pretty much between 10 years ago till now, that's pretty much contemporary. That's not even classified as history. You know, that's contemporary current events. Come on now. But did Obama, like Trump did, keep his people on deck? Say, y'all keep on. It ain't over. It's just getting started. Obama said, it is over. We have won. Go home and sit your ass down. Get back to work. Put on your boots. Stop complaining. Take off your house shoes and put on your work boots. And he totally demobilized and demoralized his magnificent, unprecedented support base. He demobilized. Obama surrendered his power and went to the oligarchs, went to Zbigniew Brzezinski, went to Benjamin Netanyahu, went to Wall Street. You know, went to the oligarchs and says, I have brought the people to heal. The people were up in arms with the housing crisis, the economic downturn. I have taken this political revolution and turned it into a reform movement. You know, I have completely taken the steam, the anger, the angst, the cause for real change and hope, and I have subdued the will of the people. Now, what will you have me do now, masters? And they say, very good, boy. Now, what we want you to do is to be a mediocre statesman. We want you to advocate for mediocre change, segmented change, and we want you to sustain and reinforce and legitimize the status quo. Very well, master. You know, Obama was Darth Vader. And the oligarchs, the same people who always been in control, that though they're the Sith Council, the Lord, what's his name? Sidious or whatever, Darth Sidious, whatever. But Obama was Darth Vader. He looked big and bad and black, but inside was a sick, feebly white man. The soul, the heart of Obama is a feebly little white bureaucrat sitting behind a desk crunching numbers. Weak policies, very weak policies. I mean, we thought we were getting a new deal. We thought we were going to have a Marshall Plan for the hood, reparations, infrastructure investment, incarceration of the oligarchs, and liberation of our freedom fighters. Y'all, yeah, don't lie. Like, don't front like you weren't expecting. Don't front. Remember, even Obama said we're going to have one-page mortgages. Forget those 80-page mortgages. It's all these loopholes, and then we're going to simplify. No more housing corruption. It'll be a one-page mortgage. We're gonna streamline the home purchasing process. You know, remember public option, socialized medicine, all medical, not just abortion, but all medical services on demand and without apology. Y'all forgetting what Obama was. And just like y'all in the streets crying now, white racists, the same people that were cheering, that are running up on Muslim women, pulling off their hijabs, walking into Starbucks, calling people niggas. Them same white folks was in the streets trembling, literally pissing themselves. Oh, Lord, they got a Black Panther in office. They got a Mau Mau, a socialist in office, a Muslim in office. They were scared as y'all was. But we voted for a fake progressive, and they voted for a real fascist. And Obama is a closeted fascist, you know. So get what you get. So Trump has finally accepted the fact that the oligarchs. But here's the good thing about that. Trump is at war. He's creating an internal class divisions. Now, I don't know. Black folks are real keen on us getting along, white people dividing us, but we never ever entertain the thoughts of dividing whites. Or let's depart from the concept of dividing white people, but exploiting white divisions. You got white women in the streets, white gays in the streets. You got white environmentalists in the streets. You know, white folks, just like when Obama won, white people, the white right, went out and bought record numbers of guns and ammunition, and they went out and joined white ring and white nationalist organization in record numbers. When Trump won, white people gave millions of dollars to Planned Parenthood, white liberals, and what they say over the weekend, the ACLU raised $24 million in under a week. So white people gave copious amount of money to liberal organizations and given even more, you know, environmental groups. So now they're beating the hell out of each other right before our eyes. And what do? Do we step back and say, what's our interest in this? What side should we play off the other? How can we advance our particular agenda and our particular interest in this time of turmoil? No, we say, well, I'm joining with the whites. Some, you know, you either with Omarosa or who's that guy that didn't go, what's his name? The congressman, John Lewis. You either Omarosa, team John Lewis. You either going to be a Sambo, New Negro Democrat, or a Sambo, Uncle Tom, Black Republican. And there's a significant number of these black, give Trump a chance. Give. You know, anyway. But there's openings here. And we've never taken advantage of these other pivotal divisions either. But I just think we should realize what's at stake here. We need to have a class analysis. And we got to come up with a real strategic plan, because nobody's paying attention to black folks. You know, literally every time I see a protest, women's march, immigrants, he ain't even started on the gays, but the gays are already ready. Like, I wish you would. Come. Defense of marriage, bring it. Even under Trump, the gay, they just allowed the LGBTQ, shout out to y'all, because the Boy Scouts just said they're going to allow transgender boys into the Boy Scouts. There is some exception for Mormon sponsored, I don't know, Mormons. I mean, Mormon, talk about a sovereign country. Utah is a Mormon states of America, or a Mormon state. It don't even, the laws of gravity and physics don't even apply to that cult. Remember they made Dennis Rodman apologize because he said he wasn't with that Mormon vibe. The religion that preached that black people didn't have immortal souls got the nerve to tell a black, the worm, to apologize because he said he wasn't really feeling the vibe there. Anyway. I mean, so even under Trump, they winning. You know, and actually the log cabin Republicans. But that's a whole nother thing. But guess what? You know what month this is? You know, and what y'all gonna say? I know what y'all saying, but y'all not. What month is this, y'all? Ready for the drum roll? This, the month of February, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the month of February, wait, let me just, yes, the month of February is Gay History Month. Yep. Now, okay, but there is a qualifier there. In Europe, in the UK, February is Gay History Month. So calm down, you damn Umarites. Y'all don't have to share your month with the gays in America. Gay History Month is in October in America. Okay? It's not. But just calm down. So if you do a Google search in February, Gay History Month, and it's like, yeah, it's February, and you just understand it's in Western Europe, February. Y'all, month is up to February, still yarn. It still belong to yarn. So it's yours. Calm down. You don't have to share it with the gays. You know, you can even tell the black gays when they try to come up on their Alec Baldwin. You know, when they try to come up with their brain of rush and say, just wait till October. This here is Black Man History Month. And women. You know, they did boil the coffee for the civil rights meetings. You know, they did press the suits that King wore so well. So they did make that contribution. But this here is Black History Month. You take that on down to October. But yes, it's Black History Month. And, okay. And it's also February 1st. It's Langston Hughes' birthday. You know, and that's why Carter G. Woodson gave us Negro History Week, which we expanded into Black History Month and stopped there. You know. So, maybe one day I'll share my essay, The Triumph and Tragedy of Black History Month. Who heard John Lewis on NPR last night? He had a detailed interview on NPR. It was just surreal, if I don't say so myself. But anyway, I'm long past a break. Dang, 756. Okay, you listen to Bro Diallo Show, Q4 Radio. Yes, I'm back. Yes, I got in legally. Didn't have to climb through nothing. Didn't have to crawl under nothing. Got in. And I'm here to do the show. And hopefully there'll be no more breaks. But I sure would love it if y'all went to Diallokenyatta.com made a donation, you know, shared the link with other people so that they can know about the show so we can grow this. You know, I'm back. I don't get discouraged. You know, it's like the pedophile, incestuous, bestiality rapper Kevin Gates said, I don't get tired. You know, struggle is struggle. But anyway, let's hear from Langston Hughes, because today is Langston Hughes' birthday. And I actually didn't like Langston Hughes, because my freshman year in high school, they tried to get me to do this poem called I Too Sing America for my freshman year at Bishop Hogan Catholic High School. I was supposed to get up in front of all these white people during February and recite dramatic. And it was like a choreographed poem, because I was like a theater dude, you know. I don't know if they had the word for theater geek back then, but theater was my thing. Not basketball, but the performing arts, acting. And they were like, well, we want you to do this dramatic reading of I Too Sing the America. And I had some vague familiarity, like, okay. And then I'm like, give me the poem so I can memorize it and, you know, do the choreographed dramatic reading of it. And I'm like, I'm not reading this crap, you know. And I said, I want to read Claude McKay, If We Must Die. And they was like, guess what? Guess where you're going to be during the Black History Assembly, nigga? You're going to be sitting in the aisles. You're going to be watching this show. You ain't in it no more. You know. But so from that moment, like my freshman year, I'm kind of like, forget Langston Hughes. But then when I went off to college, I started reading more. You know, you can't just define a prolific and great artist in mind by one work. You know, we all have our off days. But I'm like, Langston Hughes is that I Too Sing America. And I wasn't really even feeling the whole Harlem Renaissance either. You know, I'm like, how you going to have a rebirth of something that was never existing? What are you rebirthing? I mean, we came in here in shackles and chains. So what are we rebirthing? What are we bringing back? But anyway, I read Simple Speaks His Mind. Just Be Simple. And even though it was a book of fiction, it was just so, it was brilliant. Not breathtaking, but brilliant. And so then I was reintroduced. And of course, my wife is like a literary whore. Like, she literature, you know, I've got my history books, my political, my ideological texts. And she's squeezing in like literature and anthologies of literature. Like, get that stuff out there. Ain't no time. These here is my bookshelves. You know, you get the kitchen cabinets, I get the books. I'm joking. Calm down. That's not really the comment. But anyway, my wife started reintroducing as I was giving her copies of the Communist Manifesto. She was giving me books by Zora Neale Hurston and stuff. So, you know, it was a good exchange. That's what, you know, couples supposed to do, build each other up, expand each other's horizon. But anyway, I was reintroduced to Langston Hughes. I'm like, wow, this dude could write. James Baldwin and all the other Renaissance writers and thinkers and artists. And so, you know, happy birthday, Langston Hughes, who I rediscovered my respect after losing respect for him because of that I Too Sing America. And since I'm talking about, let me share I Too Sing America. And then I'll put some other pieces up. So in honor of Langston Hughes's, what's the fancy way, the cultural way, rebirth, awakening, arrival, dissension from the universe, emergence from the womb, whatever. They always have a fancy way of saying stuff like birth or birthday, born day. I had to keep up with the cultural jargon for such things, because I just say birthday. So, but anyway, in his own words, ladies and gentlemen, the poem that made me resent, if not hate, Langston Hughes, I Too Sing America. By Langston Hughes.
I Too Sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat well and grow strong.
I'm about to go on.
Tomorrow, I'll be at the table when company comes.
Just the airways.
Nobody'll dare say to me, eat in the kitchen then, Besides, they'll see how beautiful we are and be ashamed. I, too, am America.
Or find the show archived at DiallokenYatta.com. Please go to DiallokenYatta.com if you can and make donations. Help us to build...
I, too, sing America.
Thanks for watching live.
I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow, I'll be at the table when company comes. Nobody'll dare say to me, eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful we are and be ashamed. I, too, am America.
Okay, that was I, Too, Sing America, and I left my mic live when I was logging off of Facebook Live. But anyway, that's not all we got from the late, great poet Langston Hughes. And I'm not even saying it's a bad poem. I just think I don't like the words are good. It's wonderful words, but I just don't like the theme of trying to too sing America. Y'all can have that.
Bring me all of your dreams, you dreamers.
This is Dreams by
Bring
Langston
me all
Hughes.
Of your heart melodies, that I may wrap them in a blue cloud cloth away from the two rough fingers of the world. And that is what poetry may do. Wrap up your dreams, protect and preserve them, and hold them until maybe they come true. Columbus dreamed of finding a new world. He found it. Edison dreamed of light, more light, and he made light. All the progress that human beings have made on this old earth of ours grew out of dreams. That is why it is wise, I should think, to hold fast to dreams. For if dreams die, life is a broken-winged bird that cannot fly. Hold fast to dreams, for when dreams go, life is a barren field frozen with snow.
Good evening. Tonight, Mr. Langston Hughes, American poet, dramatist, novelist, lyricist, lecturer. He's in town to give a lecture at UBC, but he's here tonight to read poetry, his own poetry, to a jazz accompaniment. We have Alan Miller to interview him. We have Doug Parker and his band to provide the jazz. And Mr. Langston Hughes has his own accompaniment, his own introduction.
Suns are setting. This is what I'm gonna sing. Suns are setting. This is what I'm gonna sing. I feel the blues are coming. I wonder what the blues will bring. Drowsy, syncopated tune, rocking back and forth to a mellow croon. I heard a Negro play. Down on Lenox Avenue the other night, by the pale, dull pallor of a one-bulb light, he did a lazy sway. He did a lazy sway to the tune of those weary blues. With his ebony hands on each ivory key, he made that poor piano moan with melody. Oh, blues. Swaying to and fro on his rickety stool, he played that sad, raggy tune like a musical fool. Sweet blues, coming from a black man's soul. Oh, blues. deep song voice with a melancholy tone. I heard that Negro sing, that old piano moan. Ain't got nobody in all this world. Ain't got nobody but myself. I was going to quit my frowning and put my troubles on the shelf. Thump, 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 when he's put on the floor. He played a few chords, then he sang some more. I got the weary blues, I can't be satisfied. Got the weary blues, I can't be satisfied. I ain't happy no more, and I wish that I had died. Far into the night, he crooned that tune. The stars went out, and so did the moon. The singer stopped playing and went to bed, while the weary blues echoed through his head. He slept like a rock or a man that's dead.
A lot of people may well see this particular gentleman as someone who makes an appearance either in a supporting or non-supporting role in many of the poems that I do. The truth is that the politics that we discuss are not partisan politics in terms of Democrat or Republican. I am a member of the Common Sense Party. And for the longest kind of a time, I have felt as though people who said that they did not care anything about politics or were not interested in it were making a political statement in and of itself. The new poetry that evolved in our society concerned the fact that folks wanted to use both words that people could understand as well as talk about ideas that people could understand. One such poem, at least an early poem of ours that went in that direction, concerned the fact that millions and millions of dollars are continually sent into outer space while we continue to face the same problems here on the ground. The poem said, a rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon, and her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the moon. You know the man just upped my rent last night? Because Whitey's on the moon. No hot water, no toilets, and no lights, but Whitey's on the moon. I wonder why he's upping me. Because Whitey's on the moon? I was already giving him 50 a week, and now Whitey's on the moon. Taxes taking my whole damn check. The junkies make me a nervous wreck. The price of food is going up. And as if all that crap wasn't enough, a rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. Was all that money I made last year for Whitey on the moon? How come I ain't got no money here? Whitey's on the moon. You know I just about had my fill of Whitey on the moon. I think I'll send these doctor bills, airmail special, to Whitey on the moon.
All right, that was Langston Hughes. Capped off by my personal favorite poet, Gil Scott-Heron. So I figured since we're doing poetry, might as well sneak in. And I've been wanting to play that, you know, when I was having issues with that. I've been wanting to play. I wanted to do a whole show talking about historical contributionism and the hidden figures. And I was definitely, whenever I hear people talk about hidden figures, it always, Whitey on the Moon comes to my mind. I don't know. Maybe I am a hater. I am all this negativity emitting these negative ions into the universe. Negative, negative. So be it. So freaking be it. I'll be that negative one, that negative sun. All right. Somebody wanted to ask why I was in special ed. I was in special ed because I failed the fifth grade. The reason I failed the fifth grade, long story short, is because, you know, that particular year that I was in the fifth grade, I had moved. I think I went to 5 different schools and I had about 6 or 7 different addresses over that my first stint through the fifth grade. And I was a very class. You got to read Kwanzaa Kujufu, The Conspiracy to Destroy Black Boys. And I recommend that Kwanzaa Kujufu reread the book he wrote called The Conspiracy to Destroy Black Boys. Or at least he should retitle the book The Accidental but Good Intentioned Destruction of Black Boys. Because I went to see him give a lecture at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm like, hey, Kwanza Kanjufu, this dude really much wrote my biography, my academic biography, without ever meeting me, because I was a victim of fourth grade failure syndrome. And he says, you know, black boys enter school, kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade, wide-eyed and bushy-tailed, eager to learn, enthusiastic, eager to please. And by the around the fourth and fifth grade, their shoulders are slumped and they're totally disinterested in school. And that the school system systematically deconstructs and destroys black boys. Now, and I know our feminist sisters, but hey, the dude chose to write about black boys. You got an issue with that? Hey, ain't nobody stopping you from writing The Conspiracy to Destroy Black Girls. And that book was written, actually. And it didn't get as much play, so perhaps sexism is a part of it. Perhaps there is some validity. Freud is all up in that little... Get out of here, Freud. And take your slip with you. Validity to the fact that black girls and their suffering in particular plights and how oppression particularly affects black women is not given as much weight. You know, they're right. I'm sorry. They're right. I'm not sorry. They're right. And nobody should apologize for that. It's not right. But anyway, but this is the conspiracy to destroy black boys. As if you can destroy black boys without in concert, in turn, destroying black girls. But then again, he did talk about the academic statistics for girls and boys, and there is some divergence. And you know, common oppression affects and impacts us differently. But anyway, the dude wrote my academic biography. And so I was a victim of fourth grade failure syndrome and fifth grade failure syndrome. And up until that time, I was a model student. Even though I always had struggles, or my family always moved around, I finally, you know, started falling down. And then, even then, they didn't really take any of that, my home and my financial circumstances. You know, my mother had substance abuse issues and, you know, there's, you know, a lot of stuff. Typical story. Not really typical, not stereotypical, but typical for somebody from my, you know, demographic and class. But anyway, I was supposed to go to summer school, and I wasn't even stable enough to attend summer school appropriately. And then, even though I went to summer school, missed a lot of days there, I was able to become eligible for the test, and the special test that determines whether or not you'll pass the grade. Because you're supposed to go to summer school and then take this competency. See, I did fully deserve special competency test. And my mother wouldn't take me. And I remember in my first round of the fifth grade, I was like, Mom, yo, I need to go to school today. I'm supposed to take some special tests. And they played us because, you know, when you go to summer school, after summer school ends, because, you know, summer school is half the summer. You have the first half of the summer for summer school and then the second half for the second wave of summer school children. And you got to pick one or the other. And then they gave the test a couple of weeks after all sessions ended. So you got people who are already unstable. And then they should have given the test on the last day of summer school or the last week of summer school. But instead of having these people who are already unstable go home and finally begin their summer and live their lives. And then you're supposed to just show up at this one particular day to take this one particular test. And my mother didn't take me. So I wasn't able to take the test. So not only did they put me back in the fifth grade, make me repeat the fifth grade, they put me in special ed. And I don't know. I knew other people that flunked and didn't have to go to special ed, but I was in special ed. And I actually love special ed. You know, it's weird, but if you look at special ed back in the 80s when I was in the fifth grade, and you look at special ed, the elite classes, like the upper echelon schools, they teach them the exact same way. It was very free and open. Now, I don't want to go into the particular, but I actually really like special ed. And they were planning on keeping me in special ed all the way through my high school career, and I turned to school. That's what they were setting me up for. But I kept scoring very high on the aptitude test. Back then, we used to have like the Iowa test of basic skills. So I was just blowing away these tests. And so there was some school official, I don't know, probably the school nurse, had went and said that you had gave this complaint at D.A. Holmes Elementary School, Kansas City, and She went to them and was like, you've got black boys in this special ed class that are outscoring the children in the regular class. That is an injustice. So me and a good friend of mine who was in special ed with me, I don't know if I could say your name. May I say your street name? Randy Skills. I won't give you government. But we were both, we actually became friends. I met him in special ed, and I've known him to this day, many, many, many years. You know, we actually got into a fight in that class. And, you know, back in the day before guns were introduced, you fist fight with somebody, and then they're your best friend. You know, it's like an initiation. But anyway, me and him took the Iowa test of basic skills. We blew the test out of the water, upper percentiles, whatever, you know. And so they actually drug us out of special ed and say, y'all get in the regular classroom. So I tested out of special ed when I wasn't really supposed to. And I also had, you know, behavioral issues and stuff. You know, little knucklehead. And so then I just went. But I always had academic problems, you know. But for some reason, I was good at taking tests, you know, and passing tests. But that don't really mean you're learning stuff. Scoring high or scoring low, it's not really a measure of your aptitude. But Whitey saith, and thus it must become truth. So that's how I ended up in special ed. Just, you know, unstable housing, you know. And like I said, I don't really have any super, like, precious type tragedies, you know. And even coming up, you know, I always knew somebody who had a lot worse than me, you know. So I don't really get around to being like, oh, woe is me, but it was wild. Actually what I had entitled as I was doing my research for the show, I had entitled the show, Jobs, Applying for Slavery. It was Jobs, Slaves Demanding Shackles. Because Trump was the jobs president and he promised to bring jobs to America. And people just think jobs are inherently good, but they're not value neutral things. A job could be good, a job could be bad, a job could help you or a job could hurt you. A job could extend your life or shorten or end your life. So when you're saying jobs, you have to give qualifiers. Will it be a job with the appropriate compensation, appropriate safety regulations, appropriate autonomy and dignity for the worker? You know, and that's not what Trump didn't. And that's one thing. Trump is the most honest, pathological liar in the world. And that's why it's so hard. Nobody can really get a bead on Trump. Because he's an honest, pathological liar. And his honesty comes from his stupidity. He doesn't know when to tell lies. So he tells really stupid lies. And he tells really hard truths, which he doesn't understand that he should tell. So his honesty is a direct byproduct of his utter stupidity. So Trump will sit there and say, 3 million people voted illegally. I don't know if it's definitely not true. But maybe Trump doesn't even know he's lying when he's lying. He really believes his lies. And that's a pathological liar, a person that lies so intensely that they've already convinced themselves before they even started to try to convince you. Oh, and by the way, let me give the number. It's 312-985-7834. Now I'll say it one more time slower, because whenever I hear someone read a phone number over the air or anything like that, I never get it. So maybe I deserve to be in special ed. Who knows? Maybe it wasn't racism in the system against me. 312-985-7834. It's the number. Q4 Radio. You can come in live and direct on the air and speak with me and to the people. Okay, so Trump would tell a lie that he believed to be true. I believe he believes it because he's a pathological liar, and the lies are truer to them than reality. So he said 3 million people voted illegally, and not only did 3 million people vote illegally, 100% of those people voted for Hillary. But then he tells a truth that he's not stupid enough that he shouldn't have told this truth. But then again, his support base is so damn stupid. As Gil Scott-Heron said, his ignorance is only surpassed by the people who voted for him. So Trump in the first debate got up and said, wages are too high in America. We've got to bring wages down. And then a popular lie that he tells and all Republicans tells, that if you demand higher wages, then that will force automation. So demanding higher wages, enough wages to live a dignified life, is going to threaten the job. And the whole point of having a job is to live a dignified life and to meet your basic needs, to have the resources to not just meet your basic needs, to go into survival mode like a cockroach, but to give you access to some of the fineries of life, like a book or two, a vacation or two, to pursue other interests besides toil. Right? That's the whole point of a job. But then they say, you can't demand higher wages, paid leave, sick leave, family leave, vacation time, or else they will automate, which is a lie. Because guess what? Even in time when slavery, when you had zero pay for labor, automation was always preferable to the mercantile class, to the merchant class, to the owner class, to the eventually became the capitalists, the feudal lords. So even slaves get displaced by technology. So there is no wage low enough to protect yourself from automation. Look it up. When the cotton gin came, they needed more slaves to pick the cotton, but they didn't need no more slaves. They were innovating industry. They were innovating and modernizing agriculture, even when most workers were not paid. Because guess what? Even if you don't get a wage, you still got to eat poop and you still going to get sick or injured. Or you might get a notion to bash the boss in the face. Sit down strikes or slave rebellions. So there's really no amount of bowing you can do to capitalists to stop their exploitation. You know, that's like saying, what can the cow do to avoid slaughter in the meat industry? Maybe if the cow retrained, got more skills, was willing to eat a little less hay, willing to emit a little less poop and methane gas. There's nothing the cow do. The very system is set up to slaughter you, no matter what. Even if you're a cow, if you're too skinny to be eaten, they will cut you up and grind up your bone meal for gelatin. They will sell your hide to the leather industry. There's no way to end the exploitation without destroying, completely and utterly destroying the cattle industry. It's the same thing for workers. You are a human resource. Just like livestock. Just like coal and coltan, you are a resource. And no matter how many benefits you're willing to surrender, how much pollution you're willing to allow the industries to emit into your environment, they will always do more. The only thing that the capitalists want is more. Nothing else. So you can have Bill Gates, who's worth $70 billion. They project in the next decade, Bill Gates will be the first trillionaire in the world, and he swears to God that he's trying to give away his vast wealth. It's just really hard to find people who need money. I swear, I'm not joking. Look it up. Just go to DuckDuckGo and put in the search engine that doesn't track you and say, Bill Gates, first trillionaire. And they will say that he's trying to give away his money to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He just can't find anybody that needs money. I tell you, these oligarchs live in a different reality as they destroy our reality. They really think they're going to go to a mountaintop in Chile or some deep underground bunker or fly and terraform Mars so they can exploit and destroy the planet's ecosystems and acidify the ocean and render the earth uninhabitable by humans because they think their fiat currency will give them a pass. They're crazy. They're hoarders. Billionaires are money hoarders. Now, if they were hoarding cats, if they were hoarding newspapers, if they were hoarding old flea market goods, we'd know they were insane and we wouldn't give them power. We would lock them in padded rooms. But if you hoard money, you're not only a hero, you're not only a person to be honored, you're a person worthy and deemed worthy and qualified to run the state, the apparatus of the state. And that's on us. That's not even on the billionaires. because they're such a small class. They said 8 people got the equivalence of 3 billion people in terms of personal wealth. Why don't the 3 billion of us kick the snot out of these billionaires and just take their stuff? How did America come to be? It was just take it. Just take it. And then after you take it, write a law to justify your taking it. That's how wealth is built. No shame to the game. Up you mighty race, up you mighty class, you numerous hordes. It's time to bring back like the Mongolian hordes and just ride on these billionaires and their security guards. We outnumbered them, we outgunned them, we could crush them. The ruling class is so minute that they would drown if we all spit on them at the same time. You know, it's going to come to that because they're not even trying to exploit you. They've got plans. They got algorithms in place planning how they're going to exploit your great-grandchildren who aren't even born yet. That alone is an act of war. Class war. Class consciousness. Anyway, let's get back to jobs. So Trump said the unspeakable truth that wages are too high in America, which isn't true. Wages have been stagnant since the 1970s, and in most industries, since America, the United States moved into the post-industrial economy. Because the United States used to have an industrial, had the first and second. The first industrial revolution was in Great Britain, 1840s, and it was brought to the United States. The second industrial revolution, the U.S., you know, took to it like a moth to a lamp. And the United States, after World War II, after the, you know, barriers to trade, because the United States used to be a mercantile state, meaning that a protectionist state, you know, a producing state, industries, textile. My grandmother and great-grandmother both worked at shirt factories. Can you believe a shirt made in America? They worked in a textile mill. But, you know, and we'll see how much we can get into this, but wages since the 1970s have been stagnant and declining. The only income that has ballooned is investment stock. Not only are you able to make more money from your money, you're able to keep more money. And it used to be that social stability was maintained through progressive taxation. And so if FDR basically said you can be rich in America, but you can't be filthy, stinking rich. Because if you have filthy, stinking rich people, they tend to become, they do two things. They use their power to serve their interest over the interest of the masses. So they subvert democracy and they become obstructionist, meaning currency means to move, you know, a current means to flow. And currency is to keep the economy going. But if you have $70 billion, $8 billion, $500 million, I don't care if you're balling out like Mayweather. You can't burn through that much money. So if you have an individual, it's better to have 5 people spend $1 million than to have one person with $5 million. It's better to have 1 million people with $1 than one person with $1 million, because those 1 million people with $1 are going to put that money into services. They're going to spend that money and keep the currency flow, keep the economy moving, keep people employed, you know. And when rich people get too much money, they lock it up in places and they clog the arteries of the economy. And so the economy becomes what? Stagnation, stagflation. The economy becomes stuck. And then you have governments and in private individuals all jockeying, trying to convince these wealthy people to let loose their money, to invest in this, to donate here. And you're not free if you're begging oligarchs for money. You're back to, you know, a monarchical system, essentially. So the government said, we're not going to ask the wealthy to invest. We're not going to beg the wealthy to make donations. We're just going to take their freaking money because it's our money. You don't own the currency. So what he basically said is, you know, we're going to allow for wealth in this nation, but we're going to regulate wealth like we regulate everything else. And so you can be a millionaire. You can even be a multimillionaire. But for when you make your first $1 million in profit, every dollar you make over a million in profit, we're going to tax 99 cents of it or 97 cents of it. So you only keep 3 cents of every dollar. So what the oligarch is going to say, well, I've made my first million. So, you know, they can do things. I've got enough money to buy my yacht. I've got enough money to have a cast made of my anus so that I can make chocolate treats in the mold of my anus. And yes, they have that service. That's what rich people, when rich people have too much money, that's the kind of nonsense they get up to. Anus chocolate shaped candy. You know, I can put gold flakes in my pudding and eat gold and poop gold flake poop. That's the kind of stuff they get up to. It's not productive behavior. They're not buying, you know, food for the children and all that kind of, they're not engaged in productive consumption. It's opulence. If you call that opulence, I wouldn't want to eat that, but if you got money to burn, you know, literally YouTube videos of people flushing money down the toilet as other people starve, balling out. And black people are a minstrel mockery of that, but that's not real wealth. So what the man has to say is, I've made enough money to indulge myself. And so now I have to decide with my greed, do I want to take this 3 cents on every dollar? But if I take the money and invest it in new technology, if I take the money and donate it to various charities and interests, I can do other things with the money. And therefore, either the government's going to decide how this money is redistributed, or I'll have to decide how the money is redistributed. But the money will be redistributed. I cannot put it in an account, lock it away somewhere forever, and then go do some Scrooge McDuck and swim through my money. That's not an option. We will keep the currency flowing. And when this was imposed, and on top of that, there are other regulations, you know, breaking up the they used to call them trust. And they used to have politicians like Theodore Roosevelt. They called themselves, I'm a trust buster. And the trusts were basically what they used to call monopolies, like Apple computers, Nike, Microsoft, those Starbucks coffees. Those are trust. Now, well, we know them better as multinational corporations, a.k.a. monopolies. ExxonMobil, Boeing. So there was this healthy tension and hostility between the state and private industry. And they used to have, and every corporation, no matter how big or what little not-for-profit LLC, you have this thing called a charter that is granted to you by states and that is overseen by the federal government, the ultimate law of the land. And they would revoke this charter, which would cause you can't take out, do exchange, you can't open a bank account in the business name, all that. All your limited liability is gone. And without limited liability, you cannot really operate in this global market. And so anyway, there, long story short, there was a healthy tension between the workers, the ownership class, and the government. And it was the government would say, we do have to represent business. We do have to serve business. But because this is a democracy and majority rule, the majority of the people are the workers. So we have to give greater reverence to the will of the people than the will of the ownership class. Now, that only was a brief window in American history. And in that brief window is when the middle class was created. There was no middle class. Up into the Great Depression, the Roaring Twenties, they go look up the Gilded Age of America. Remember, they say, well, we haven't seen this disparities of income since the 1920s. The pre-Depression America. You know, the Roaring Twenties, they called them. The economy was very strong. But as Noam Chomsky said, as I often repeat, within a capitalist economy, the wealth of the economy has no direct correlation to the wealth and well-being of the society. You can have a stock market doing record numbers and the people being miserable, people suffering. Alan Greenspan, they say he was the greatest chairman of the Federal Reserve ever had, said that one of the key elements to a healthy economy is worker insecurity, meaning that workers are too afraid to quit their jobs, too afraid to ask for raises, too afraid to assert their rights as workers and citizens. That's good for profits. So Trump was voted into office by the working classes. At the same time, he openly admitted that he was going to subvert the interest and standing of the working classes. Because now they've got people say jobs, jobs, jobs. And jobs are the be all and end all. We need a job. But nobody is talking about the quality of jobs anymore. And I'm not just talking about income, the fight for 15. That's not really relevant. And let me tell you why. As I sip my green tea, let me tell you why. A minimum wage means absolutely nothing without a maximum wage. You cannot, if you build a house without a ceiling, it doesn't matter how good the floors are. What's going to happen? We all know people get a leak in their house. What happens? The floor starts to wilt. It crumbles. It collapses. So you could pay people $1 trillion an hour. Money is fiat. It's not based in anything. Because if you give workers $1 trillion and the elites got quadrillions, then your trillion is still nothing. So you have to put a ceiling. You have to fight for a maximum wage. At the same time, you fight for a minimum wage. You know, so as a worker, you and Trump was elected on jobs, and Trump is like, I can bring jobs to America. All I got to do is get rid of environmental standards, do away with workers' rights to appeal. That means if you work for Boeing, this billion-dollar multinational corporation, you as an individual has to negotiate for your income, your rights, everything you get from this job, this billion-dollar corporation, they know that they can replace you as easily as Beyonce replaces lovers, you know. And so that you do away with unions, do away with regulations, and reduce and suppress wages. And the rights, the overall rights of workers. And the America is built on a pride to say, look, United States is the land of the free, home of the brave. Where do you spend the most of your waking time? Not just your day-to-day time, though. Not just when you wake up, where your most active and productive time. Where do you spend the majority of your productive years? At work. And you have no rights, constitutional or other rights. You don't have a right to privacy. You don't have a right to assembly. You don't have a freedom of speech. All of the constitutional rights you take for granted that are the federal government's violating, when you identify yourself as a worker, you totally give those rights up. It's no different than enlisting in the military. When you become a soldier, you're no longer a citizen. For the time that you're a worker, when you're on the clock, you're no longer a citizen. You're a commodity. You're a human resource. So this fight for jobs, anybody can bring jobs back to America if you're willing to turn America into Vietnam, into China, into Haiti, into Honduras. Look at the label on your phone, Hacienda in Mexico, the Maquiladoras. These are places where workers, if you're going to work a job at some of these factories, you'd be lucky to work for 12 years. Not because you retire, but because there are no environmental standards. You're inhaling toxins. When you go home, you're walking through toxic sludge because they just emit it. Your water is contaminated. Your food is contaminated. Your air is contaminated. Because there are no environmental regulations. Because environmental regulations mean you're going to lose your job. Because the corporation is going to pack up and move away if they have to tend to the environment. They're going to go to a country that doesn't have environmental regulations. So you're lucky to get 10, 20 years of that job that doesn't pay you crap. Our mission, we did not evolve with our opposable thumbs and our magnificent cerebral cortex, our capacity to be self-aware. We did not become these advanced creatures that we are. This magnificent product of evolution or God's divine creation, whatever, however you define the human existence. The human being. Did we evolve to be jobs, to generate resources for the 1%? To generate wealth and comfort and power for the 1%? That was the whole fight. It wasn't even about money and the labor struggle. As Marx understood, it's about alienation. Where we're no longer humans, we're just commodities. And now we embrace it. Something that would get, there used to be a time. Where the boss is. Now, we're getting back to that because capitalism is showing its ugly hand. Somebody threw feces on that Mark Scarelli guy. But he's just the symbol. He's just the tip of the iceberg. So we're either going to embrace our slavery, our techno-barbaric society, our cubicle plantations, and our digital cotton, or we're going to have to bring back the guillotine, the glorious revolution of Western Europe. You know, the heroic slave uprisings. So what you going to do, wage slaves? You going to fight for jobs? You going to fight for extra rations? A better cot and an extra bucket of chitlins? You know, we need a worker uprising. We need to revisit labor history. One thing that made me most discouraged when I became a member of the 1199 Healthcare Workers Union is that they didn't teach labor history. And if you don't want to go back and read the ancient, just go back and read the labor section of the People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn. It's a very tight and cogent labor history. Very, very, very astute, you know, and just labor history, all of human history, as Marx defined, said all of human history has been essentially a struggle between classes. Class struggle over control of the means of production and resources. That's historical materialism. So you had, even in our much worshipped and beloved ancient Egypt, you had bosses and workers. You had pharaohs and common folks. And many of those pharaohs were not gods. They said they were gods. They weren't gods. They were people exploiting other people. Now, it wasn't as bad as it is now. You know, the pyramids wasn't built by slaves. The pyramid workers, you know, they you know, have determined through historical, linguistic, and anthropological research, intensive, that they were actually workers. You know, there were jobs defined. It wasn't a mercantile economy, you know. But currency goes all the way back, what do they say, to 1700 BC, North Africa, and the islands that span the various islands that are between, you know, southern Italy and northern Africa, the earliest forms, and not the earliest, but the earliest known currency, minted coins that were used as a medium of exchange. 15,000 BC, so we're always going to have money, you know, if you're going to have civilization. I mean, currency developed alongside civilization. And civilization is basically any societal structure where they're able to bring in resources from the outside, where you can have a group of people living in a space where that local ecology cannot sustain those group of people, like cities. Civilization means city building. And so, like the city of New York or Chicago, we could never, the amount of land that the city of Chicago sits on could never sustain this number of people. So if you go anywhere in Chicago, you see these big trucks, you see these big trains full of cargo bringing in the resources. Uncivilized people were basically people who live within the ecological limitations of their environment. They didn't consume more energy and food than their environment could produce, and their numbers didn't expand beyond what the ecosystem could sustain. That's uncivilized. It had nothing to do with killing people or not killing people. It had nothing to do with who was cannibal and who wasn't. Because this society, civilizations, were much more brutish and violent and homicidal than primitive societies. You know. But then we have this Eurocentric view of society, so we all think, you know, man was not civilized or man was not living good until the Renaissance. We were all in a primitive state, as Hobbes said, you know, before the time of kings and civilization, life was brutish and short. You know, he said it was lonely, brutish, and short, you know. And Leviathan is an interesting read, not so much for the history, but for real penetration into the European psyche. So I'm over my time. Dag nabbit. See, I got so much, missing all these days anyway. And I got to shake the can, y'all. I need donations. I need support. I need help. I need y'all to share, get the word out about the show. But But I got to wrap this gavel up. I will be back tomorrow to talk a little bit more about labor. But I also want to talk about what we're missing as we watch the Trump reality show. What are we not looking at in this art of political war when they're making noises in the East? What's going on in the West that they don't want us to notice? So I'm going to go over the top 20 or maybe top 10 censored or ignored stories from 2016. What are the real threats beyond Donald Trump's lunacy and psychopathology to the world and our well-being and the future for our offspring? This is the Bro Diallo Show. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see y'all Friday. Peace.